and welcome to Sundance on the Weekend. We take a break from the normal broadcasting. We got 2 hours today and 2 hours Sunday, and I'm Rick Bruff, and my co-host this morning, back with us after several years, is David Darcy. Who are you with now? You're a roving vagabond.
Well, yes. As a roving vagabond, I'm with Ann Thompson, and I saw her off at about 1:15 this morning. Nothing happened between then and now, I can tell you.
You're a married man, for one thing.
I'm a married man.
I've had a crush on you for years.
And I was taking pictures of three dancers who were wearing practically nothing on Main Street last night, but they were inside, so they were warm. This was a party for the film called Finding Fela, directed by Alex Gibney, about Fela Kuti, the great Nigerian singer. The party was as good as the film, as a documentary that everyone should see. But so I'm writing for Screen International as a critic. I write for The National in Abu Dhabi, which is a newspaper that covers all the Middle East, English language newspaper. And I'm heard a lot on BBC Radio and seen on BBC Television. And there are all sorts of other affiliations. San Francisco Chronicle is a daily paper I write for all the time. I'm writing for them from here. So the list goes on. I think you heard enough about that.
Yeah, well, just to remind people, you co-hosted the Sundance coverage with us for a lot of years with Blair Foner. And last time I think you and I did something together, we were in the little broom closet studio up in City Hall.
Right, but there are no small studios, just small broadcasters.
Yes.
And I thought we did. Let's put it this way. Dennis Quaid and Tom Church didn't think we did such a bad job.
Oh, good.
As they stumbled out, hungover. Yeah. So, you know, I miss it, and it's great to be back.
Yeah. You're in the new studio, much nicer picture window view.
Yeah, and somebody even said here that I looked great, so people are still lying in public radio.
Okay. And introduce the two guests we have to kick things off.
Right. We have Ann Thompson, who is radiant at 8 o'clock in the morning, the creator of Thompson on Hollywood, which is on IndieWire, the great film blog. And we have Bob Burney, distributor, producer, and a great source on all things independent. And I hope he'll give us some encouraging news today, because the New York Times, the newspaper of record, decreed that there are real problems in independent films. An independent film that can be solved, I guess, most initially by the making of less of them. So anyway, here they are. Bob, let's start with you. Let's just say he's so famous that his name tag was misspelled this morning. So if you're looking for a guy named Bob Barney, B-A-R-N-E-Y, you may get a response from him. Bob, you are here not to sell films, not to buy films, but you're here to look for money. Is it easier to find money here than it is to find a film that might be commercially viable at the festival?
No. I mean, I just started Picture House, which is a company that I started in 2004 and have just relaunched it. So I am, looking at all the films and also trying to find partners. But I think there are quite a few films here. I mean, I've just started. It's only been a couple days, but for example, one of the ones that the opening night film, I think, turned out to be quite a surprise. Whiplash.
Oh, tell us about it. Did you go to see it, Andrew? But give us. I haven't seen it yet. So, Bob, tell us a bit about it.
Well, I mean, it was interesting because it came from a short that was here only last year. So, as Cooper said, I think it was the quickest turnaround of a short to feature, and it was stunning film. About jazz drumming, but it could be about football, sports, anything where there's a coach or a teacher that is such a perfectionist that he crosses the line to, you know, bullying, torture. He'll do anything to make you a great artist.
And toxic bullying. I thought of Full Metal Jacket. And I thought of performance anxiety. I thought about those nightmares that you get in the middle of the night where you're standing on a stage and you don't know your lines. You know, it's about that.
It is about drumming, right? So I brought Lars Ulrich, the drummer of Metallica, to see it yesterday.
Name dropping as
guy.
Usual.
Did you,
right? I called him.
Did you cure cancer on the way?
No, but listen, Lars is such a film buff, so he's here at Sundance because I wanted to say, okay, you're filming these actors doing these amazing drums. So I wanted Lars to tell me, okay, is this? Did they do it right? Did they really? And he said he was blown away. I mean, Miles Teller, the young kid in the movie, is a drummer, but he's sort of an amateur rock drummer. But these are complex things. So anyway, it was. It is, as Ann said, it's the Full Metal Jacket of jazz drum movies.
Because when I saw the description, I was thinking, isn't this Amadeus on the drums?
Yes. Yeah, it's Amadeus. It's also Black Swan. It's a horror film.
Yeah.
It's a horror film.
It's intense, actually. I was squirming. I was squirming in my seat. It was very intense.
I started kicking the person in front of me. You know, I was drumming. You couldn't help it. And people look around and go, why are you kicking me?
You're supposed to do that with the DVD, right. not in the theater.
Yeah,
so
that?
Do you think, is there, just for our audience, Bob just distributed the Metallica documentary. So he has some experience with music films. Do music films have a head start in the sense that there is a crossover audience that might reach art house, independent crowd, and a music audience, or a musical investors who come in on the front end?
Well, yeah, I think so. I think there's been a lot of, mainly music documentaries, and there seems to be quite a few here as well. You mentioned Fela, but I think it's sort of a built-in audience that you can reach with the audience or whoever the film's about. In Metallica's case, you know, reaching their audience on social media, and they're connected. So, think about 20 Feet from Stardom last year. So it's a good genre, and I think most of those films do get picked up and get distributed in some form.
Back to your original question. I do think a lot of people are talking about this whole question of what the viability of distributing this huge number of independent films. And Manola Dargis of the New York Times was distraught on some level that the paper of record had to review something like 990 movies last year. And a lot of it has to do with triggering these deals and VOD and being able to show in other platforms. So you need the theatrical release in order to justify that, and the New York Times review specifically. Yeah. And around the country, people don't see movies as many theatrically, but the barrier of entry has become so low that it's like music. You have little tiny movies. And Bob, I am curious to know what you think, where this sort of distribution economic model has to go. I mean, it isn't in the right place right now, that's for sure.
Well, it's for the micro distributors and all the different ways to put films out, it's probably an interesting time. People are buying films that, that may or may not be a distributor or have any way to put it out. Then they try to find a way to put it out. But the prices are pretty tough. So if you're a producer or a filmmaker wanting to sell your films and you're hearing about all these outlets, one thing you also hear is there's no money. You know, to buy your film, but we'll take it. So there's a lot of places to go, but economically, you know, to actually be able to make the movies with any revenue, it's scary. There's a lot of films in New York. It's interesting that the Times policy of reviewing every film is probably the only place, right? How many?
No,
there's no other outlets. So
it may change.
Yeah, it may have to, although, you know, or Manol and Tony, they're going to have to just go 24/7, you know, reviewing. I mean, it is tough. I hope it doesn't change because having that coverage in the Times has always been kind of the way to sort of validate the film, and filmmakers want that and to do anything to sort of set that up, which probably forces a lot of films into small theatricals that shouldn't, or it doesn't matter.
That's right.
Or an alternative might be, and this seems practical, although I'm not terribly encouraging, is that you get certain films that get placement in the hard copy and online, and the second tier is that the other films are just reviewed online. Because if there's one thing that has that enjoys even less esteem than independent film, it's a film reviewer, and these guys come surprisingly inexpensive on the marketplace. So, you know, they're there and they're available in the films. And you know,
They don't necessarily have that credibility or that authority that somehow the New York Times possesses.
Yep, that's true. That let's just say that is another thing that is coming into question also. The credibility of the reviewer and the value of the review in the marketplace for a lot of films. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, well just I guess what is the Times definition of define every film? Because even leaving that independence, I take it the directive is not to, you know, the horror, sci-fi, comedy, romantic, melodrama stuff that would just go straight to tape.
If it has a full-bodied, one-week theatrical run in New York, and that's the question, should they change the barrier of entry so that it's more rigorous?
And you have – I mean what you have is this odd mini-economy of theaters – which are four-walled, meaning that the distributor pays the cost of releasing the film, just to get that review in the New York Times to give whatever credibility there might be to the film. So yeah, it's turned into its own little kind of economy with its own logic.
And how many credits are on staff at the Times?
They have two full-time, and they have three, I think.
And then they use
a lot of freelancers.
Yeah.
Well, the cheapskates could maybe hire, you know, this. You know, Roving Vagabond or something.
I've done it.
He's actually he has his highs and his lows in terms of work that's available. And I have to say, I'm busier than a lot of journalists, which is kind of discouraging. But look, when we're looking at numbers, I've been talking about this for. I did a story last year in The Guardian around this time. Are independent films just expensive blogs? First of all, we do have too many films made. And Bob, you were saying this 10 years ago. This has gotten worse. This is a kind of a dog bites man story, frankly, because everybody's been talking about it.
Yeah, no, it's more than ever. I don't know if it's, you know, again, it's not necessarily bad in that how do you, you know, who's going to define, you know, what should be made and what shouldn't. And these opportunities somehow are making more films be funded and purchased, and so it has an effect, and you never know when something's going to come out of one of these. So,
Beasts of the Southern Wild is one example of something that came out of nowhere.
Well, yeah. I'd argue it didn't come out of nowhere.
At the Institute,
it had been a play before that. So there was some history to this, the film Beasts of the Southern Wild, which was one of the great successes critically out of Sundance. Was it 2 years ago? Right, 2 years ago.
But 2012.
Looking at numbers, having been through making a documentary film and having difficulty distributing it, looking at numbers of films that were really critically acclaimed, you have things like Leviathan, a doc from last year. Every critic loved this film. It was on 10 best lists. People said it was an extraordinary work of filmmaking. You had Kirby Dick's film, The Invisible War. Neither of those films at the box office, total box office in the United States, broke $70,000.
But Invisible War went on, which was 2012, went on to be, you know, nominated for things. I mean, it had
a significant policy
on television too.
Effect also. But the numbers, I hate to use this cliche, but the numbers, even for critically respected films, often do not add up. Any thoughts?
Well, the documentaries and some of the smaller art films, you know, there's other goals oftentimes. I mean, particularly with documentaries, like to actually, you know, affect people, change policy, you know. So it is tough, but I do think they probably come out from the ancillaries or, you know, television.
Yeah, just for our audience, tell people what ancillaries
well,
are.
Well, just through digital releases, iTunes or Amazon or smaller webcasts. I mean, there's ways for these to get out there. Whether the numbers work, you know, is questionable. But some of the films are getting out, and I think that's probably the point. There are more ways to do it.
Okay, we've noticed that, and we've been told that video on demand for many films has been the way to reach the marketplace and actually monetize the project. Talk about that, and talk about how difficult it might be to validate that assertion, i.e. that here are the numbers, this is how much money it's made, because these are not public numbers.
That's
right?
The problem.
Yeah, they're not public, but enough is going on that you have the sense that it's working to some degree. So companies like IFC Films, Radius, Magnolia have either gone to policies where they open in one theater or a few theaters at the same time they're on video on demand, or they're on video demand 1 month before they appear in theaters, which is called Ultra.
And they charge a premium.
And you pay more. So, you know, it's become the way, you know, like 5 or 8 years ago, you would say, look, your film has gone direct to DVD, you know, or direct to video, you know.
And that was the mark of shame.
It was, and yet at the time there were several films that went straight to video, in quotes, that actually made a lot of money and worked. Like, and now it's become a way, when the bar for doing a theatrical film has become so high and so tough and so expensive, that the video on demand is definitely a viable way to do it. You still don't have the real numbers, and you can't say that it's equal to, say, a theatrical, but it's starting to, in some cases, work. But you have to have names or you have to have a pure genre film to make that really work. In other words, on the video on demand, if you don't know about the film, how are you going to find it? When you go to your interface, everything's kind of alphabetical.
Right.
So if something has stars, you know, you might find it, or if it's a specific genre.
People are making their movies titled AAAA so that they can be – I'm not kidding.
Is that really true?
No, it's like the Yellow Pages. AAA action adventure movie.
Triple X, yeah.
No, you could have action adventure adult, which would give you, the trifecta. Yeah.
But Margin Call was a movie that did well, and they boasted about it afterwards, and Arbitrage. You know, these are VOD hits, if you like.
Well, The Killer Inside Me, which, I gave it a – I said in a review for Screen, I don't know how many years ago was this, 4 or 5 years ago, Michael Winterbottom's adaptation of the James M. Cain novel, the second one to have been made, by the way.
No.
I think it's Thompson.
Bill Thompson.
Jim Thompson.
Sorry, that's right.
I know my own last name.
That's right. I apologize. It's early in the morning. I'm told it was sold to IFC for $1 million. And they did $2 million on VOD. Have you seen those numbers, Bob?
I haven't seen the numbers, but I think, you know, that's a great example of it had a cast, you know, that, and it was a, you know, no matter how, even though it was Michael Winterbottom, you would say, you know, think of genre film, but it was. Or from a Sundance film either last year or the year before, Bachelorette, that looked like kind of a smaller version of a big studio version with big names.
That's right.
You know, that... Those movies found an audience because of the cast that were immediately recognizable, or a certain genre that you thought you knew what that movie was.
Right.
Well, but Bob and Ann both. I mean, since we seem to have passed now officially from one era to the other with the official death last month of Blockbuster, so we've gone from the era when these, you know, untheatrical movies maybe attracted attention at the video store. Maybe they didn't play in my theater in Salt Lake, but they put a banner about it up at Blockbuster or something. And now we've left that age and gone to, as you said, the video on demand. Is it worse now for those pictures to get attention, or was it just, you know, about the same situation when they were, you know, in the stores?
I think it's actually better now. I think the digital, the VOD, and all the outlets, it's actually better because more people, you know, theoretically might hear about them or see them. So I actually think it's probably better.
I didn't hear that Blockbuster collapsed. So, you know, it shows you what I'm watching.
Well, I do think that there's a marketing gap, and there are movies that just don't have festivals become very important. Sundance is a place that helps to establish a title or give it a buzz or give it some kind of profile. Critics, there are online critics who do that, who established a following and a real audience. Someone like Drew McQueenie of Hit Fix comes to mind, or The Playlist, which is on IndieWire, my sister blog. But there, it's harder. And I've always remembered this one guy saying that nothing replaces 5 weeks of word of mouth in a theater. And I don't think anything has replaced that. Yeah.
No, I don't think you can, because word of mouth is the ultimate way for people to hear about films. And it is very tough. That's the one thing that theatrical gives you, a chance for people. It buys you some breathing room for people to talk about the film and then get to see it. But still, I feel like it's probably... there's probably a shot to get your film out there in some way now, and with all these outlets.
Yeah. Well, for instance, for a film like Quiplash, what's the prospects of getting that out into a broad number of theaters?
I would say it's very good. I think that's a strong film that will definitely get sold. If not, I'm pretty sure it probably got sold last night.
Who do you think bought it?
I would say any of the players like Roadside or A24 or even a bigger company might buy a film like that.
It
will get great reviews. It has gotten really good reviews so far, and it's a film that could be played in the newer distribution model or a traditional theatrical.
And it'll play college towns. You know, it'll get a young audience. And Miles Teller is a truly exciting actor. He was great in Spectacular Now, and he really shows what he can do. Here, I'm going to talk to him later. I'm looking forward to doing
and
that.
Is there a little, again, having not a name maybe, but a face with J.K. Simmons there?
Absolutely.
The guy from the farmer, from the insurance commercials. And that,
or
that
Oz.
Was crazy.
J.K. Simmons.
Or Juno.
He's one of my favorite character actors. And now in this film he has a lead. And he's outstanding and very scary. He kind of, these close-ups on his face kind of look like in Disney's Fantasia. Remember the kind of mountain devil? You know, he is intimidating.
Okay,
great.
Well, speaking of that kind of face, has either of you seen Frank with Michael Fassbender?
Yes, I saw Frank. Although I didn't actually see. Don't want to reveal too much. You don't really see Michael Fassbender's face.
Seems like a waste to me.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of women are complaining.
We're not happy.
Yeah, exactly. So you have an asset, if we can call it that, with a face, but you see a paper mache head on, or whatever it's made of. You see a big head that's covering him the entire film. Is that right?
Yes. He is a very shy, kind of disturbed, man that is trying to make art and be in a band, but he can't face public, so he's able to survive with this fake head but it's 24 hours, so even his closest associates have never seen him.
What did you think of the movie, Bob?
I mean, it was very ambitious and experimental. It's kind of a polarizing. Film. People are going to love it or hate it.
There were some raves on Twitter.
Yeah.
Right. So
it's a very cool film,
So presumably the double feature is the dodo bird of the film industry, so that we won't see a double feature of Whiplash and Frank, two indie music films.
Well, they're actually related in that way. In other words, it's funny because seeing them back to back, that they're both music films and they're both about, trying to make it and be a perfection, because it's the same thing. And it was interesting. And there's a lot of interesting music in Frank. It's another music film. So there's definitely a theme going on.
Why is that? I mean, as somebody who just had a music film in cinemas, why is this happening? Why the music films? Are there enough of them to identify a discernible trend here?
I don't know. I think music is so critical to all films and it drives them. So I think it just makes sense. But I think about artistic or creation or finding a voice, is a theme that, and just finding a way to go in your life, that music and art, are subject to these films.
Are there things that you... Talk about other things that you've seen we haven't done.
Rory Kennedy's documentary, Last Days in Vietnam, which was excellent. You may remember all those photographs of people, you know, trying to climb onto helicopters, and it's really about the last days in Saigon, when there was no really carefully planned evacuation, and there was this mad rush to get people out, and the heroes in the U.S. military who actually had to go behind the backs, under the radar of the ambassador who was blocking all of this. I didn't know any of this, and it was there's some dramatic footage, archival footage, and they brought the real guys to Sundance, and they were there last night, and they got a standing ovation. It was wonderful.
Let me say something quickly about that. There is an eerie feeling with music from the time, almost like elevator music, that complements this refusal to recognize what the United States had already said, that they weren't, they had said they were going to defend Vietnam, they'd made a decision not to. And right before the panic, and it's really a cinematic evocation of what was inside at the time.
Eerie parallels.
Okay, we have to thank producer Bob Burney and film critic Ann Thompson. And just real quick, Ann, if you got a book out.
Oh, thank you. That's so kind. The $11 billion year from Sundance to the Oscars, an inside look at the Hollywood system. I know that's a mouthful. That comes out in March.
Oh, okay. It's not at Donnelly's bookstore yet.
Not yet.
Okay. Wait, if you pay a premium, can you get it on VOD?
You can get one little plug here. You can get Metallica Through the Never on VOD next week. Next week.
All right.
Thank
you,
for
Bob and Ann.
Thank you.
Each week, KPCW produces 5 public affairs programs. Join us at 9 a.m. weekdays for Mountain Money, This Green Earth, The Mountain Life, Cool Science Radio, and Fun Friday, sponsored in part by Prudential Utah Real Estate and San Francisco Design.